Tonight is the fourth talk in the series on time, and this one is entitled Fractured Time. Fractured Time. And as we speak about time, I want you to get a feeling for how, when we're talking about the precision of time and the concise quality of time, because time is very it's very scientific, isn't it? It's very clear, clicking of the clock. It's very mechanical is what I'm trying to say, very mechanical. And as we go through these talks, when we allow time to intercede in our life, when we give our life over to time, which most of us have long since done, it's not occasional, it's continuous. We give ourselves over to the mechanical, to the display of life that's very predictable. And what you'll feel as we go walk through this talk is the absence of heart. It's just everything that we so wish for in our life cannot be found within the from the face of a clock. And it's very dry. But it's very precise, you see. I had two nursing friends who were both very dear friends. One was extraordinarily efficient, and she would get the pill on time to that person. And she would get her all of her paperwork done and was extraordinarily clock-oriented. The other nurse was much sloppier, much less precise, and was much more, who would spend time at the bedside. And getting the pill, she would get the pill within a reasonable length of time, but it wouldn't be right on the button. And the second nurse was talking to me about how she wishes she was like the first nurse, that she got her paperwork done because her supervisor was always on her for not getting her paperwork in. And I said, you know, Evelyn, if I were sick, there's no question who I'd want at my bed. I would want you. Because I don't care if the pill gets on time. I care about the relationship, because that's where the healing is. That's where all of life is flows. Not through the precision, not through the quantitative approach, but through the qualitative approach. And that's what we're bleeding out of our medical field, really. We're training in the precision, but we're bleeding out what the healing factor, which is one of the reasons we're probably 42nd in the world in healthcare quality or whatever. Because the other one isn't quantifiable, you see. I can't record it. I can't record the effects it has. And therefore, why really pay attention to it? I can record when I offered the pill. So this sense of time is an important component in how much we are driven by this sense of time, how much we've ingested it. In fact, even to speak about myself outside of time, time is myself. We have to understand that, as we have mentioned in previous talks, time is generated through our thinking, and that's fairly obvious. We can see that very quickly. Even a beginning student can have some conceptual idea of how he or she thinks their past into creation in this moment, and how their future is anticipated but isn't an actual expression of now. And so we can get a sense of how we do that, but we still give ourselves over to that momentum. We don't, I mean, it's a enormous thing to just have an insight into it. It's completely different to have a realization of it. A realization is an ingestion of what this, where this points. All of spirituality is pointing, is searching. The point of all everything we're doing here is to search for the unmanifest. And all we see with our eyes or our senses is the manifest, is the experience of life. And yet the yearning of our heart to come home again is really the yearning for the unmanifest. Because when we live in accordance with the manifest, we live with the precision of life. We live with the dry factor. And the residue of time is on everything. Let's look around. Everything is laced with time. Everything, the residue of time lives within us. It's as soon as we bring forth the residue of time, which is immediate within experience, because the mind engages as a computer would in the assessment of what it sees in terms of what it has seen or what is expected to see. And as soon as it brings forth that recollection, time comes into play. And reality, the now, becomes refracted, like light going through water. It just moves off at a slight angle to itself. In terms of ponderance, let me ponder that. Let me reflect on what you're saying. Let me think about what you're saying. That slight holding back, that slight residue of time in everything we do. Just, it seems like it just is just keeping us right from the immediacy of now. But it feels so necessary. I mean, who would we be, literally, who would we be if we didn't ponder, if we didn't think about what was happening here? As I was sitting in meditation, it was interesting because so much of my early meditation training was in terms of sort of looking at myself and trying to get a feeling for what was going on in my mind, as if somehow the mind was going to tell me something that was so invaluable, some perhaps secret door of my past would open and an analysis or a justification of who I always was would be seen, and oh my God, you know, so I have to keep this constant attention on myself. Which was just re-encouraging that sense of self-reflection. It's a necessary step for most of us in the development and understanding of what the mind is. But we hover far too long thinking that this watching ourselves is going to bring forth the final crescendo of our understanding. Oh, it's now. Oh, now I. Oh, and or our moods are really going to say something that's so meaningful. Oh, I understand now. I understand why I'm feeling this way, as if there was some secret in there or something. It gets kind of like, so what? So what? We're having this emotion or this mood. So what? It just doesn't. What? It doesn't form into anything. It just doesn't mean anything. It isn't going anywhere. It's not pointing anywhere. It's not pointing to any certainty. It's not pointing to any confirmation. But time seems to think it is. When we're embedded, when we're ingested in time, time seems to have its own logic. It has its own intentionality. It thinks that everything that comes up has something to do with my past and where I'm about ready to become, and that I better keep a quick and steady attention on this, or what I will become won't be what I want to become, and my manifestation will be all skewed, and I've got to, I mean, you know, the worst of me could come out here. And so time harbors us, it corrals us into itself. And so everything, when we have given ourselves over, become enslaved by it, everything holds the residue of it. We can only see from it. The known, you see? When we see, when we look out, everything is known. Why are things known? Because it holds the residue of time. How could anything be known except through time, right? We've known it, or know of it, or know about it, or know how to extrapolate what it is. So everything holds the residue. And what we yearn for is the unmanifest, the timeless. We're what we yearn for, because when we live within that, we live within the impossibility of accessing our heart. That's what we live, and because it feels as if it's safer to live this way, it seems as if it's safer for me to have this constant residual knowing of time. But is it? See, these are questions of deep contemplation. And I hope you take these questions seriously. I hope you move with them in your life. And I hope there's a thirst or a hunger in each of us that longs for what's on the other side of this thing, the unmanifest. Because when we sit down, that is what the intentionality of sitting down in our meditation cross-legged, that's where it's pointing. That's where it's pointing. We take a position that we don't take in everyday life. We take a physical form that is strange at best. And we don't move. And we hold in our body the stillness of timelessness. And we let time pass through the stillness of timelessness. We let time pass through. And we hold what's passing through. What holds what's passing through is passing through. What sees what's passing through is the timeless. And so, we begin to understand that we carry that sense of time internally, but we behave like it's external, like it's an external influence. Have we noticed that? We behave as if time is happening to us when we are doing time. And we then feel pressured because we project out that time is something happening to us. And then we get stressed and anxious. Never realizing that we are the culprits. So we have to look, you see, where we start in this thing. I mean, I can give you all sorts of pictures of X, Y axes and, you know, but what does that do? Do you even follow that when you carry it out of here at all? We have to make it relevant to our life. We have to make this thing relevant. And if we make it relevant to wherever we are, and most of us live within the relative, most of us do that, if we look at the pain that time brings, where we live and how we live, which is where I'm really directing tonight's talk, and we keep looking at that and we are really serious about focusing in on how we're creating the sense of time which creates the problems that I have generated throughout my entire life, and we really start seeing into that and releasing ourselves or our need to act and to be in that particular configuration of time, we will find, when we open ourselves, when we let go, we will find ourselves in the timeless. So the timeless isn't something we seek. It's something we discover by letting go of the pain of time. So we back ourselves into the timeless. We don't go looking for it. Okay? You back yourself into it because you see where time is just, it makes no sense to live like this any longer. So let us look at the relative, starting with the pressures of busyness, and productivity and the pressures of what time does to us. And yet how easily we give ourselves over to the mechanisms, to the persuasion of that pressure, of that anxiety, never asking where that anxiety is coming from and never seeking a refuge outside of it. We just continually, day after day, even knowing what we know now, give ourselves over to the pressures of time, because everybody's doing it. You can see everybody in the rat race. As somebody once said, even if you win the rat race, you're still a rat. And the comparison, once we bring time into the equation of our lives, then we have all of the things that time contains. Contains distance and measurement. And therefore, we have comparison and evaluation and contrast. And we have competition. And all of the inward judgment, which is an extrapolation of that, of time, of that comparing, contrasting. And sometimes we think of time as being a friend because things are going well. And as long as things are going well, then we relax and we are at ease with time. And at other times it works against us. Mostly we feel like it works a little bit against us, especially when we start feeling our aging. But always we hold it to be outside of us as if it were a third thing. In fact, when we talk about the dimensions of height, width, and length, we often talk about the fourth dimension of time. But time is a creation of consciousness. So if you're going to bring time in it, you have to bring consciousness into it. So the fourth dimension is consciousness, which is interesting to me, because scientists don't seem to be able to take that into consideration. In fact, Einstein talked about the relativity. Excuse me as I move slightly into the science here. I'll be back shortly. But Einstein talked about the relativity of space and time, that those two were relative. In fact, you couldn't separate space and time. Those two, you had to talk about space-time. But actually, there are three, space, time, consciousness. You can't separate any of those out. Which is interesting to me because, you see, consciousness is what we ask the questions from. Few people ask questions about consciousness. We take the reality as the platform from which we will ask questions. But we very rarely ask questions about the nature of consciousness itself, or we would see that the relativity of space and time was held within consciousness. So this sense of the relative of time, the relativity of time, and yet we take it as such, with such extreme, I mean, it's, we talk about, you know, we talk about being more productive, being more efficient, being more precise. Everything has to do with the gradation and clarification around time and the mechanics of living. And at the other end of that spectrum, you can hear it. You know, the heart won't enter, the heart can't enter. Where's compassion in that? Where's love in that? You can't find love on a slide rule or computer disk these days. And so when it's left as an abstraction, something happens to us, we then treat it as real, like we treat everything else as real. We treat time as real. And when we treat time as real, then we're under the influence of time. And so time has a dramatic impact on our life, even though we're generating it. It's so silly. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard a hospice patient tell me or ask me, how much time do I have left? As if it was a commodity, as if they knew they would somehow be better off. You have 3 months. You have 1 day. You have 1 minute. What difference does it make what I say? What difference does it make? What are you going to do with whatever time is left? What are you going to do with that? How does that make a difference? See, if I said 10 years, oh, now I can relax for 9 years and 364 days. And then I'll get upset, right? And then I'll get anxious. And however much time we have left, it's too soon, isn't it? I find that so interesting. I had a 97-year-old woman dying on her deathbed, looked up and said sincerely, why me? What do you say to that? It's too soon. It's too soon. If you died today, it would be too soon. If you died in 30 years, it would be too soon. So how can we be uninfluenced by time? That's really a question. You see, I have found two very different avenues to approach the subject of time and to completely understand its influence on us so that we can step out of time. One of those is what we're doing in this series, is self-understanding, seeing how we inflict time on ourselves, how we create time internally. And as we begin to see ourselves do that, and we begin to see the walls and of the prison that we build within this fabrication, we get quiet. We get quiet. And so studying how the effects of time are on our lives, and that it's all mind-induced, and that I'm running from myself. And we can do that from a very simple, the simplest activities that we do throughout the day. When you're speaking to someone, and you're just there speaking, but there is that clock inside of us that says that there are other things that we need to do, and that this is limiting me from doing those other things. See, that is the last hold the mind has on us before we actually abide in compassion, is believing that message. Because we're not with the person, and it's felt cellularly by both people. And so we are waiting for them to get bored or whatever and turn away so that we can move on. Basically, we're in a waiting game. And we can see that internally. We can see that. That is thought driven. What we're doing in that moment is living a life that is not yet manifest. It's that we are totally lost in a future rearrangement of what I need to do to be productive and useful or more purposeful or more intentional in my life than sit here and speak to somebody. However, when we get to that thing, it hasn't stopped. The same momentum goes through that next thing that we thought was more important than speaking to that person, and on we go. It's like dominoes that keep falling. And we can see that, though, if we're willing to. Or we can just float like a cork on the waves of that forever. But it takes intentionality. It takes groundedness. Okay, I'm going to see this thing. And I'm going to see, What is doing this? What is calling me? What is beckoning me away in this moment? What is pulling me out of this moment? It's just my mind and caught in time. That's all. That's all. Chasing what it says is more important. Pursuing a more intentional future than the purposeful now. Okay. But know we're doing that. And start looking for that pressure, internal pressure in each little thing we do. Don't dismiss it. Brushing your teeth. That's what these, in the beginning class, I offer markers, these little activities, opening doors. You know, are we missing the opening of the door for going inside? Are we missing the walking in order to get to the store? Are we missing the life of the reaching in order to procure what it is we're reaching for, the apple? Watch how we keep giving ourselves away in time. Make it a study for yourself. But you have to want to see this thing. And to want to see it, you have to understand that your spiritual life depends upon seeing it. Because you'll never reach the timeless pursuing time. If you think you can meditate your way out of time, forget it. It cannot happen. Our intentionality has to be towards looking at the ground we stand on rather than using the ground to find and search for the thing that we're looking for. That which we're looking for is that which is looking. It is the reality we're assuming. And until we see that, we miss it. Completely. So that's one of the ways. That's one of the ways. The second way is also one that I've pursued to some depth, and that is the way of death. Because death, you see, is the ending of time. And it's also the ending of self. Why? Because the self is time. You think you're going to survive that one? Well, Jesus said I will. Well, that's fine. If you want to hold on to a belief system, that's fine. But we don't know, do we? Not really. We love to believe and project a sense of continuity into our death and after our death. That gives us some solace. That's why religions form, is to give us some sense of solace within an unknown experience like death. But that's not the point. The point is to hold the I don't know and to realize that death is going to happen. And I don't know what's going to happen after that, if anything. Now there is the fertile ground to end time. We have to be willing to go through the jarring fear experience because when we hold time, time holds fear. We invite fear. If we live in time, we invite fear into our life. Because what is fear? But the thought that something is going to happen in the future. So if we invite time, we invite fear. If we invite time, we invite a whole sense of grasping relationship to the future and a whole sense of ponderance and remorse to the past. That's what we bring in when we allow ourselves to abide in time. So now that we've all agreed to do that, and we have at a very early age, let's bring in a subject which starts decimating that intentionality, and we bring in the subject of death and dying. Now, the next series of talks I'm going to do after this series is on death and dying. We're going to do four or five talks on death and dying. Because I love to follow this with that. Because it's just right in our face. So the first thing that happens is because we're in time, when we start thinking of death, it scares the hell out of us, which is why we don't think about death at all. We deny death because to think about death is to eliminate everything we feel is purposeful and meaningful. All our relationships, everything. So, better not to be thought about. And therefore, if we don't think about death, we have to deny change. Just a small thing. And so when change does happen, which is inevitable, it reminds us of our own precarious perch in life, and things get a little shaky. But to say, okay, let me just start looking at and allowing, bringing in, encouraging the subject of death. And I don't care where this takes me. If this makes me shaky, I'm willing to go through that because we have to go through that. That's what happens when the foundation of time starts being rattled by something that doesn't hold time, which is death. It starts shaking the foundations like a 0.9 earthquake, a 9.0 earthquake, and the whole thing falls. But if we're willing to persevere with the subject, and most people aren't, it has to be your lineage. It happens to be my lineage. If it's your lineage, you'll persevere. And then when you go through the subject, what comes out of that subject, what comes out the other side of that subject, isn't fear any longer because time has been decimated. You see, it takes everything. Because when you consider your life and my life, our lives in relationship to death, nothing withstands that. If there wasn't death, then everything we are doing now would be supported. Accumulation, greed, of course, do everything. Why? You aren't going to die. Might as well get as much as you can. Rob it. Steal it. Do anything. What does integrity mean? Why? See, the lack of death, permanency, supports accumulation and greed. And me. It supports me. Which supports those other things. But when you bring death into the equation, then everything is decimated. Everything. What? So there's this tremendous confusion that comes from that reflection. And what comes out of it, what evolves, what is seen out of it. You see, once all of the buildings are fallen, 9.0 earthquake, everything's decimated, that's it. Land is flat. Now the Sphinx rises from the ashes. Is the preciousness, appreciation. Appreciation is held timelessly. Time can't hold appreciation. Appreciation not for anything, just for itself. Directionless appreciation. Timeless appreciation. And now we live with death, not as something in the future, but now is death. Now has consumed everything. The knowing, the residue of time is not, I'm no longer caught in the net of time. Because death has blown that away. It has shown time to be a complete fabrication. It has shown that because it is the ending of time. I've seen that. I've looked into the eyes of the dying, and I've seen myself die. And what is left is the heart. What is left is everything meaningful. And so death allows the questioning of time. So for the few of us in which that subject actually brings us alive, which it is meant to do, then this next series might be of help. But when we go back to the pain of living within time, prior to the reflection of death, when we go back to what our lives are like, when we live encased within the idea of time, then we get, there's something very interesting that we can see. And we can see it at whatever level of depth or experience we have in our life, which is really where the homework is pointing. And that is how time compartmentalizes us, how it freezes us in terms of sections off, walls off, certain aspects of our life from one another, in which we try to protect one compartment from another compartment from another compartment. You know, the working you and the family you and the leisure you and the one that loves just walking outdoors and the one that hates traffic jams and all of the different ways that we try to keep and segment and compartmentalize our life from one another so that on the weekends we feel betrayed if our boss calls us from work because this is not work time, this is my time, and those compartments should not influence one another. And where is this compartmentalized sequence that we have laid our lives out for? Where is that? It's just a conceptual way that we have, well, what we have done is try to organize our life so that we have our satisfying components, our comforting components, our pleasant components available to us, and our unpleasant components walled off from the pleasurable ones, so that we can neutralize the impact of that part of our life we don't like on that part of our life we do. And yet, it somehow gets all screwed up, doesn't it? You know, so that we mean to have a nice vacation, and we get a flat tire, and you know, someone of our relatives dies, or like it doesn't move in accordance to the compartmentalization that we feel we've kind of arranged the blocks. We've got it all blocked in here. We've got the blocks here, and this is how it's all supposed to. Because time isn't held that way. And we think we're outside of time, and that we can draw these kind of artificial limits on ourselves. So that I'm sitting in my bedroom and my child comes in when I'm sitting, and doesn't she know that this is mommy's time to sit and get out of the, you know. The fluidity, where's the fluidity of experience? See, it comes from thinking of time as outside, as something that's being, is something that we can arrange, like we can arrange deck chairs. But we can't. We can't arrange it. We can't arrange it that way. And so, at some point, we have to say to ourselves, this is all my time. It's all my time. Now it's my time with the family. Now it's my time at work. Now it's my time in a traffic jam. But at no time hasn't it been my time. We have to break that compartmentalization. The spiritual journey demands that. So that the fluidity, the harmony of experience across is never diminished at all, from one compartment to another. Now it's my time to be mindful. Now it's my time not to be mindful. Now it's my time to be aware. Now it's my time to do this. Now it's my time. No, there has to be, seek it, go back. What's common there? What's common, commonly held through all those experiences. What's common to all those experiences? Find what's common. Don't go out to see where the differences are. Find what is common to all experience, to all experience. And there will be no more separation from one experience to another. So this sense of me being here in time, like, you know, what am I going to do at 8:30? Like 8:30 was has some quality outside of me. Like it's something happening to me. 8:30 is what happens in the moment that 8:30 happens. This is what happens. Or that. That's 8:30. 8:30 isn't something that happens to me. It's what's happening. Do you see that? The sense of me and 8:30 rises together. It isn't something that happens. Where am I going to be at 9 o'clock? As if it were something outside of me. 9 o'clock is me when the clock strikes 9. This sense of fracturing time, is something that every one of us can work with. Every one of us can start working in the right way towards this thing. This isn't some talk about some specialty subject. It's really a talk that is a unification talk in all traditions, in all practices. Find what is common. What is it that's undiminished, regardless of circumstances? As a friend of mine, which I have mentioned before, and I apologize for those of you who have heard it before, but I love it because it is holds, as the way she told it, held the truth of it so clearly. She says she was in her car with her three children, all five and under, and she was taking them all somewhere. The five-year-old to school, and And she was in a traffic jam, and she was late for the preschool that her five-year-old was going to. And horns were honking, and, you know, it was dead stop. And the kids were screaming or playing or just having a fit in the back seat. And she was getting increasingly agitated and upset. And all of a sudden, an insight occurred to her. She said, "I will always be in this car." And then she realized, she really meant it, that this is the forever of her experience, that there wasn't going to be a time in which she was going to be outside of this experience. And therefore, there is a complete relaxation of the heart and a complete workability within that arrangement. No, there was no problem, absolutely no problem after that, she said. And nothing ceased. The kids continued to clamor. They were still in a long jam of traffic, and nothing changed. Except everything changed. That's death. If you want to know what death is, that's death. And everything changed. Everything changed within that death. So look for that. Which cannot be compartmentalized, which cannot be fractured. What? Because experience can be. You can have a good experience and a bad experience, or a work experience, or this kind of experience. But what is it that cannot be contained? What is it that can't be corralled? What is it that can't be, What is the common? What's common to all things? What is common? It's a very... As somebody was dying, not just once, but I've done this several times, as the person was dying and they were not fearful, I would just ask them gently if they were receptive to it. What is it this, you feel everything ending, diminishing, all your skills, all your abilities, everything seems to be eliminating itself here. What remains? What is undiminished? What remains undiminished in our experience, in any experience, in all experience? That's the spiritual journey. Not to configure more rigid compartments or fracturing ourselves in smaller pieces. That's going the wrong way. But what remains undiminished? And may we all know that. Can we sit for a minute or two? So if there are any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to dialogue with you. Yes.
One of the ways I noticed that it blocks out time.
Yes.
Is when there's a deadline, and I suspect that almost all of us have experiences because we work in institutions that produce deadlines.
Yes.
I usually start out with because I've been really looking at this, that when I know that a deadline is coming up, I notice that I have an image of what it will look like when I have accomplished that.
Yes.
But as time moves further toward that, and I haven't been able to accomplish all the pieces that will produce that image that I have, that I notice that I begin to release bits and pieces of that image that don't match with what I'm capable of doing. Am I making sense?
Not completely, but let me just see if I... You're saying that as you get more... if you get less rigid in what you're demanding of the product that you're doing, the... I'm not sure whether you think, does that make it easier for you?
Yeah, that's what
I'm
noticing. Right.
Less specific on what the outcomes will be.
Right.
Right, yes, right.
But I'm still finding that I'm really working with this concept of deadline.
Yes, okay, so that's important. No, no, I know deadlines. I know deadlines. Deadline. But we have to understand where pressure comes, you see. It's very important to understand that we project pressure out to the boss, to, you know, whatever it is. We are pressuring ourselves. It's a projection, not an external truth. Really, you know, we think... I mean, no one can pressure us. That's obvious. I mean, we just don't have to. No one can force that pressure until we internalize it as to something I must do, and we often have an image associated with why we have to do it, and because we believe so strongly in that image, we then feel that the pressure we put on ourselves to maintain that image is coming from the outside because it's too painful to hold it as being something we're doing to ourselves, All we have to do is release the image associated with that pressure. I have to be the best school teacher, you know. And wait a second here. Why do I have to be the best? Why do I have to be the best? Why can't... I mean, it robs me of everything. Also, to begin to see the limitation of what deadlines do to the rest of your life until you get to that deadline. I mean, it just creates havoc. And it's never questioned. It's never looked at. It's never said, is this appropriate for me? You know, what is about my health, let alone my breath? I mean, you can do it in a number of ways. You can take your blood pressure. But that doesn't matter. You know, but that doesn't matter. I've got to. It's almost a panic attack. What is that? What is the pain? Because when there's that kind of tension and fear, there's pain of image. So what is it that I'm trying to live up to here? That I'm so afraid somebody will be seeing me as I perceive myself, which is that I'm not that, which I'm trying to present by doing this, making this deadline. See, we have to go where it's hard, or we continue the momentum of the fear, which never lets up, is relentless. And because you do get praise when you do things over and above what are expected of you or what your boss calls the average, then that praise says, oh, people are perceiving me how I want to be perceived. And then, so the image sustains itself and becomes more of a momentum, becomes more important than it was prior to the sense of praise. But the praise never alleviates the pain. The praise, you never get praised sufficiently so that you're out of pain. Even if you hold a negative self-image of yourself, and 10,000 people, one at a time, came up and complimented you, and the last person said, I don't believe you're as good as me. That's who you would believe. The 10,000th and final person in the line, after 10,000 phrases, you would believe the last little guy who... Because that's what... And none of the praise would have gotten in. It wouldn't have changed a thing. And to seek it just gives you momentary relief of the disposition we're in, the way we configure ourselves. And that's so traumatic to us that we just want momentary relief, because we don't ever perceive that we can have a total release from this particular tension. We don't believe that it's possible, because we believe it's true. And therefore, we can just have momentary reliefs in which people are praising us. But we won't have absolute relief, because we believe that the problem is true. See, we have to go to where we believe the problem to be true and prove it to be not true. And pressure, deadlines, anxiety, you know. There are certain professions like professors that are under that horrifically, because they're working with the top notch of all their fields, all the PhDs around them. And so they're competing against this, the people who've competed their way into that particular, you know, 1.001% of the population. Can you imagine the competition that's at that level? It's like the Olympics. Who wants that? You know, who wants that? Yes.
If I understand you correctly, if we're fortunate, we understand that the deadline is right now.
That's right. That's right. The deadline is now. I mean, what? Everything comes in. If nothing came in, except, you know, you didn't have to feel pain, well, that would be sufficient. You just wouldn't have to feel pain, and that would be enough reason to abide here and now. You just wouldn't have to feel the pain of time. But everything comes in. That's the thing. It's not that, now is a very comfortable place. I don't have to feel pain. Yes, you don't have to feel pain, and your heart opens. life comes in. The quality of experience comes in. And so when the quality of experience comes in, the quantity of experience is not important, as important. So it's either quantity or quality. That's what we're up against. If you go quantity, you go with time. If you go with quality, you go with heart. And you go with being affected by life. And the closer you are to life, so that you're, when you start actually diminishing your image sufficiently so that there is just life, that's full-heartedness. That's full-heartedness. As long as there's the residue of me on life, then you'll have a proximity to full-heartedness, but you won't have full-heartedness. And all it takes is one thought, because every thought holds the residue of time within it. Any thought, any word that you speak in your internally sets into play all of time. One word holds the key to all time. It's the key that opens the door of time. One word, one concept. So for the movement of mind to move in terms of one word is sufficient so that the now cannot be abided within. One word believed in. One word assumed to be true. Yes.
If you take it as true that life is interdependent and we're all sort of woven together, I mean, I understand what you're saying, that time, the concept of time begins with us and is a fabrication that we create for ourselves. But when we are so interwoven with other people who are having that same experience, So it seems to me that it's harder to escape, because it isn't just you who's creating the time compartmentalized, but that everybody around you is. And some of those people have influence and power over your life. So how is it that you manage that?
So she's saying that it's not just you, that you and I, that holds time, but everybody is doing it and running hysterically around. And how can you possibly escape from something that everybody... It's like a plague, right? It's mass hysteria, really. That's what it is. I mean, no one ever claims that this is easy, but the problem... See, it's interesting. In some traditions of Buddhism, they say when you step out of time, all things step out of time. That is literally true. It's literally true. Because what happens, and this is very hard to speak about, but what happens is that you see everything being just what it is and has all, and is the perfection of everything in its exact place. Even people running around believing in time. That's all perfectly true. And at the same time, it's all out of time. And you see both of those things. And when you see that it's all out of time, there is no pull or push to be involved with the hysteria of the relative level of people running around thinking that it's true. So when you step out, everybody steps out with you. All things are seen in their natural relationship. And that is not how we mostly see the world when we are caught in time. We see individual people running around caught in time, just like we are. But you step out of time, you don't see the world that way anymore. You see it as having everyone already is timeless. So there's the relative and the absolute that's immediately expressed here and now. And so you don't live believing only in the hysteria of people, because you can see the perfection at this exact same moment. So that's all I have to say tonight. Thank you.